Jeff Perry, welcome to Australia. I believe this is your second visit to this country.
Yes, I came at the invitation of the Astronautical Society of Western Australia in 1979 to take part in the convention at the Riverside Hotel. I read two papers, one on the Kettering Group and one on the Soviet space program.
Could you tell us briefly how you got interested in astronautics?
I always wanted to be a school teacher. I had a cousin as a school teacher, an aunt as a school teacher, and I was just told I was going to be a school teacher. And I wanted to be a science teacher. So when I went to the university, there was no shadow of doubt I was going to become a physics teacher. And I'd always believed in space travel, particularly from the time when in 1944 the V2 rockets fell near my home in Essex. In fact, this first use of space, because these V2 rockets travelled through space on their way from Germany to my country, was a hostile use, a military use of space. And I realised that it would not be too long before we saw things actually in orbit, although I must confess I didn't expect them to come quite as soon as they did. When the first Sputnik was launched on October the 4th, 1957, I was quite prepared for it. I'd read all about the International Geophysical Year and quite expected that the Oxford and Cambridge scholarship questions would have something about that. So I'd made it my business to acquaint myself with the programmes that were planned. I was particularly fascinated with the American and Russian plans to launch artificial satellites. I didn't see Sputnik 1. I don't think anybody saw Sputnik 1. People saw its rocket. But the head of science at Kettering Grammar School, he did see the Sputnik 1 rocket on several occasions before it burned up. But by the time they launched Sputnik 2 with the dog in it, I was determined to see this thing, and I watched it slowly moving across the sky like a bright star. And early in 1958, I decided I would try and take a photograph of Sputnik 2, which I did by using a Zeiss Netar 2¼ square format camera. I clamped it to the bedroom windowsill. As the satellite went by, I opened the shutter for a time exposure of about 30 seconds. When I developed the film, I found I'd got a black mark across the negative, together with short images of the stars and the television aerial, which was attached to the garage. Also in 1958, I went to the Brussels World Exhibition and saw models of Sputnik 2 and Sputnik 1. And that year, the Russians launched Sputnik 3. This was another large satellite, a geophysical laboratory, and I watched that and its rocket based on predictions which were published in the Daily Telegraph.
Jeff, you have achieved fame as the founder of the Kettering Group and are now considered the Western world's leading authority on the Soviet space effort. How did this all come about?
I suppose the start of the Kettering Group, as people come to know it now, also was triggered in 1958 by the death of the chemistry teacher. When his replacement was appointed in 1959, he was a radio amateur, G3FOZ, or Derek Slater, and I realised that here was someone with the equipment which would let me hear the things that I'd been watching. We decided that we would try and pick up signals from the next Russian satellite to be launched. I'd heard a recording of Sputnik 1 at a science masters meeting in London, and I'd been impressed by the Doppler shift, the way in which the frequency changed, went from a high note to a low note as the satellite went by. And I determined to get a recording of this to use in my own teaching in the sixth form when we came to the Doppler effect. The only trouble for us was that the Russians didn't launch any satellites in 1959. They had three attempts shooting at the moon. The first time they missed it, the second time they hit it, the third time they went round the back, photographed the hidden side and transmitted the first picture of the far side back to Earth. And then in May 1960, we heard on the radio that the Russians had launched the fourth satellite, Sputnik 4. And I can remember this must have been on a Saturday, because on the Sunday I went to Derek's and said, I think we should try and get this one. What do we need? He said, well, I've got the radio, we need a beat frequency oscillator. I can borrow that from Cyril Dobson, who was G3ICK. He said, and you've got a tape recorder. That's really all we need. When's it coming? I said, well, hold your breath. It's not coming until 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. So despite that, we decided that we would get up and make a try for here in Sputnik 4. We were lucky at the first attempt. I was outside trying to see it. Derek opened the window and said, I've got the signal. I dashed inside. I didn't think any more about looking for it. In any case, it was a bit cloudy. And we got this recording. We made several more recordings during that week. At the end of the week we got the recording which you've just heard, and we decided that that would be enough, and so we put the radio away. In the summer of 1960, the Americans launched a big satellite, a balloon satellite which inflated in orbit, called Echo 1. It was 100 feet in diameter, and this was a very bright object moving slowly across the sky, and I made visual observations of this, again based on predictions in the paper. I also realised that there was data hidden in those predictions, and by plotting the times of the predicted passes against the date, I could see that they were falling into a pattern, and from analysing the slopes of the graph, I was able, using theory published in Desmond King Healy's book Artificial Satellites for Scientific Research, to arrive at a value for the flattening of the Earth at the poles of about 1 over 298. Published this in a note to the School Science Review. In 1961, there was a conference for sixth form physics teachers at University College in London, which I attended. Coincidentally, this coincided with an exhibition at Earl's Court of Soviet Union, in which they showed some of their spacecraft. And while I was at that conference, I discovered that there was an organisation called the Radio and Space Research Station, situated at Ditton Park near Slough, which produced predictions for amateur observers of artificial satellites, who could then send in their observations for analysis to produce better orbits and information about upper atmosphere winds and perturbations in the Earth's gravitational field. These observations are done by using binoculars or even naked eye and noting the exact time at which a satellite passes the line drawn between two stars, estimating a fraction of the distance from one star to the other, converting this into right ascension and declination, and putting all the results together into a computer to improve the orbit on which the prediction was based. In the autumn half term of 1961, the predictions said that an American satellite called Discoverer 32 was transmitting on a frequency close to 20 megahertz. This was because it had a pickerback satellite attached to it called Nora Alice 2, an ionosphere beacon built by George Svensson at the University of Illinois. So not going away for half term, I said to Derek, it might be an idea to pick this one up. So we got the apparatus out again and made recordings of the signals night and morning as it passed over Kettering going north and south, and we did that for a period of 2 weeks until the satellite burned up in the atmosphere. By analysing the curves that we were obtaining to get the time of closest approach to Kettering, dividing the difference in time between passes on consecutive days by 16, the number of orbits per day, we were able to determine the orbital period and see how it decreased towards the end, and plot a graph showing how the curve dropped slowly to begin with and then accelerated at the point of burn-up. an interesting feature early on in this graph where the graph departed from a straight line in a sort of a zigzag, and we weren't sure in those early days whether it was due to us or due to the satellite. On reflection, it was probably due to us. So when Discoverer 36 was launched at the end of that year, we decided that although we couldn't spare the time to track it daily from the time it was launched, we would wait until the orbital period got down to the same sort of value where we had our zigzag, and we'd try and track that one again and see if we got the same effect. We did this in the January-February of 1962. This time, just as it reached the point where we wanted, the transmitter failed, although the satellite was still in orbit. As the two satellites were very similar, they were Agena rockets, I reasoned that it shouldn't be impossible to add our first graph onto the second one and predict the time at which this second satellite, Discoverer 36, would burn up. And we got the decay time, or the burn-up time, to within about a day. In March 1962, the Russians instigated the Cosmos program. This was a cover-all term, covering all their launches. We're now up to Cosmos 1790, or we were when I left the United Kingdom. And this word is used to disguise all sorts of military missions, failed interplanetary missions, tests of manned spacecraft in the testing phase. And we picked up the signals from the first Cosmos and again put the apparatus away. And then in May of 1962, I received a letter from a squadron leader at the Royal Air Force College at Henlow. He and his colleague had decided they would like to have a satellite monitoring project for the cadets, and they'd been to the Minitrack station at Winkfield to see the sort of equipment that was needed. They'd been appalled by the racks and racks of equipment that they had there, and decided that such a setup was way beyond their means. And as they were leaving, someone said to them, "Why don't you go and see the fellows at Kettering? They track satellites with backyard equipment." So we said yes, they could come, and decided that we'd better find a satellite that they could listen to as they were on their way to Rolls-Royce at Derby. We found Sputnik 5. And as we listened to the signal as it went by, we noticed that instead of the steady fall in frequency due to the Doppler shift, suddenly it rose abruptly and then fell abruptly, and rose abruptly and fell abruptly. And I was able to show that this was a square wave superimposed on the normal Doppler curve. And we reasoned that one bank of solar cells had failed, and that as the satellite rotated, the voltage dropped, causing a change in the transmitted frequency. We went on listening to this for the rest of that summer term, and then put the apparatus away for the summer holiday. During the summer holiday, in the bulletin for the visual observers, I noticed that somebody at Aberystwyth was actually also getting the radio signals from Sputnik 5, and on inquiries I found that it was coming from the University College of Wales at Aberystwyth. So in the autumn half term, when my wife and daughter and I went to Barmouth in Wales for a holiday, after a couple of days I said to them, or I said to my wife, because the little girl was very small in those days, I said, "Have you had enough here? Shall we move on to Aberystwyth?" So she said, "Yes, I don't mind." When we got there, I said, "Will you take Isabel onto the beach? There's a fellow up at the university that I want to see." And so I went and introduced myself to Ken Edwards, who was the technician in the physics department. He'd noticed the difference in the radio signals in a different respect from us. He'd noticed that the signals ceased abruptly as it went into the Earth's shadow, and reappeared abruptly as the satellite emerged from eclipse. So we pulled our data, and we published our first paper as Perry, Slater and Edwards in Spaceflight, the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society.
Thank you.
stage was when we had a suggestion from the Radio and Space Research Station that we ought to listen to the signals from the satellites, which disappeared from orbit after only a few days, long before they would have decayed naturally. And the transmission frequencies for these were announced by the Russians as about 19.995 megahertz. So we started to pick up signals from these short-lived satellites, which eventually came to be called eight-day wonders, because most of them were recovered on the eighth day. This was the basis of our early work, studying these signals. We never thought we would understand what these signals meant. So, of course, was when the satellites were transmitting. And there was a note in Flight International to the effect that Cosmos 32 had decayed on a particular date, plus or minus 12 hours. Well, plus or minus 12 hours really meant it was saying it came down on Tuesday or came down on Wednesday, and we knew we could do better than that because we'd actually had signals from it. By this time, the girls from Kettering High School, who were coming to the school to do physics, were actually making observations because they were using my laboratory to sit in at times when they weren't being taught. And one day, as I'd gone out to teach, I'd said, if that thing makes a noise, just note the time from the clock on the blackboard. So we wrote a letter to the editor of Flight International and signed it Barbara Jakes, G.E. Perry and J.D. Slater in alphabetical order. And she got a letter back saying, Dear Miss Jakes, you and your pupils. So we put that right, and eventually it led to Ken Owen coming to the school and doing a two-page article on Kettering's Cosmos Scholars in the space issue of Flight International the following year. I think it was in 1964 that the girls finally got a physics teacher of their own, and I lost my slave labour. So to take the place of the girls, I invited selected boys to help me with my hobby. One in particular was David Sinnott, who lived next door to me at home, and on one occasion he was entrusted with the keys to the school at the weekend to cycle up and do an observation and bring the keys back. In January 1966, I received a tape recording from Sweden from an 18-year-old Swedish student called Sven Gran, saying, I have been trying to receive satellite signals for 1.5 years. Today when I came home, my father told me the Russians had launched Cosmos 104. I immediately tuned in my receiver, and 1.5 hours later, I recorded these signals. I think you are the person who is most likely to tell me if these are from Cosmos 104. Notice that he said the person who was most likely, not the person who was best able. And I thought, poor devil, he's been trying for 1.5 years, and not only that, when he comes home, he's had to wait 1.5 hours, which is a whole orbital period. He must have just missed it before he came in. So I wrote back to him and said, yes, these are indeed signals from Sputnik, from Cosmos 104. There's another one up that, like that at the moment. We expect it to be recovered on, say, Thursday. If you care to send me the results of your observations, I will send them with mine to the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough. And this was the start of the first overseas member of the Kettering Group, and Sven has worked with us from that day to this. He's currently the head of advanced projects of the Swedish Space Corporation. He was the project manager for the satellite Viking, which was launched on Ariane early in 1986, and is currently project manager for the Nordic communication satellite Tele-X. In the meantime, he's been to China on several occasions and has signed a $1 million contract with the Chinese for the launch of a Swedish satellite Mailstar on a Long March 2. So I followed Sven's progress with considerable interest from that day right to now. A little later, he sent a letter to me saying, "After a Cosmos was recovered, I received a Morse code transmission." And I read the letter with interest and thought, well, poor lad, he doesn't really know the difference between a satellite and Morse code, and thought nothing more about it. Then, 2 or 3 months later, we had a parent of one of the boys came in early one morning to hear the Cosmos on its last orbit before recovery, and after the signals had stopped abruptly as the instrument package had burned up, we got talking, and I went to the blackboard to explain something to Mr. Manning, and all of a sudden I heard a signal. I immediately realised that this was the Morse code transmission that Sven had written about earlier, and quickly went home, got his letter out of the file, checked and found that it was exactly what he'd had, and these dots and dashes, which you will recognise as the Morse code letter T, the dash, and da-di-da, dash, dot, dash, K, this sequence of TKs were obviously from the recovery beacon of the capsule as it descended on its parachute over Kazakhstan. The interesting thing about this is that the dash in the T is twice as long as the dash in the K. Since then we've had recovery beacons of TLs, TGs, TFs, even TVs. And it's interesting that T is the common letter, and it was very fortunate that we started calling these TKs rather than KTs. Later that year we noticed that on the last transmitting pass of the day, as the satellite was leaving the range of the Soviet Union, the transmission was switched off, switched on, switched off, switched on, switched off, and switched on. There was a definite switching sequence, which was obviously something to do with programming it for restarting on the following day. So in the space of about 12 months, we'd come to identify distinct features of these satellites. First of all, we knew when the satellite was being recovered. We could tell how good the recovery was from the length of time that the TK recovery beacon lasted after it hit the ground and the signal strength dropped. And we identified the switching sequence at the end of the last transmitting pass of the day.
In 1984, you retired as a teacher, but your activities are continuing.
Yes, in 1976, they reorganised education in Northamptonshire on comprehensive lines. And our school, which had been founded by Queen Elizabeth I in 1577 as a grammar school, became a comprehensive school. This meant that instead of taking the top ability children of the area, we took a mixed ability range right the way through. And consequently, the number of very able pupils declined in the school. I don't believe that this is the best way of educating children. And although I tried to make it work and did nothing to actively oppose it, I don't think I was very good when it came to teaching the children of the lower ability. So I decided that perhaps it was time that I moved on and made way for others to initiate progress. Having retired from teaching, I was able to devote myself full-time to my hobby of listening to satellites. The only trouble is when you retire, people get the misconception that you've got plenty of spare time to be able to work for them. So Independent Television News said, "We would like to offer you an exclusive contract as a space consultant." I was very glad to accept that to top up the meagre teacher's pension that one gets in the United Kingdom. And then, at a later stage, I was asked by the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough if I would prepare the monthly supplements to their table of Earth satellites, again which I was happy to do. I've also had a chance to travel to Darmstadt in Germany at the invitation of the European Space Agency to take part in a symposium on the re-entry of space debris, in which we described our way of predicting the decay of Cosmos 1402. I've been to the United States, and I was lucky enough to see OSAT-1 launched on STS-51I in August 1985. Although it very nearly crept into September, and I very nearly missed my plane home. I went to Colorado Springs and was able to be briefed inside Cheyenne Mountain and repay it by briefing them briefly. I went to the Pugwash Conference, the 34th International Pugwash Conference on Science and World Affairs in the Arctic Circle at Borkleden in Sweden. And now I'm here in Australia, starting out on an ambitious tour, taking in the majority of the state capitals, trying to pass on some of my enthusiasm to Australians, and hope that I can encourage school teachers in this country to form a passion for a project of their own and to enthuse and involve their kids, because the easiest way to educate a kid is not to let him know that he's being educated. If you say, "Come here, lad, sit down and I'll teach you scientific method," he'll say, "Over my dead body." But if you say, "Come and help me with my hobby and listen to the American astronauts," then he comes, and if he's loyal, he sticks. Over the years, the lads that have helped me have turned out to be good doctors, dentists, architects, computer systems programmers. We've even had some that have gone into the aerospace industry. But we didn't set out to turn out spacemen or astronauts. We tried to turn out educated, good scientists, and I hope that I have managed to do that.
Thank you very much, Jeff Perry.